Good morning. Steve Scanlon on behalf of the Appellant and the first...
Just a minute.
I'm sorry.
I'll call it. I just want to make sure you're the first order of business, which apparently you are. This for the first case of the morning, Joseph Yanko versus Kenneth Angeron?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And you're Mr. Scanlon?
I am.
All right. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. This court, in a series of cases, has held that police officers cannot lie to prosecutors, cannot fabricate evidence, cannot induce witnesses to fabricate evidence. The law has been clear in this circuit for quite some time on that score. In Newsom, this court held that a police officer's failure to tell a prosecutor that fingerprints found at the scene did not match Mr. Newsom's constituted a 1983 claim, since it allowed his case to continue. The same thing with respect to this court's most recent decision, Manning. In that case, the FBI agent alleged that he had been thrown out of the FBI and they were trying to attempt to frame him for a crime. He claimed that he was placed in a jail cell with a snitch who offered false testimony against him, that recording equipment was manufactured in such a way to make it appear as if he had made statements he had not made, and police reports were fabricated. The law has been quite clear in that score for some time. Nevertheless, the court below concluded that such basically fraudulent inducement of the prosecutors by a police officer does not state a claim. In footnote 3 in the court's opinion, they say we cannot accept
What opinion are you reading from?
I'm reading from the court below, Your Honor. In footnote 3 of the opinion, the court said we cannot accept Mr. Ayanko's claim that Newsom allowed such a fraudulent inducement claim to continue. That is belied by Newsom. It's belied by this court's opinion below in Ayanko. It's belied by the Goddard v. McCullough opinion. It's simply not the state of the law. The court below also concluded that Mr. Ayanko could not establish a nexus between what the prosecutors and what the police had caused the prosecutors to do and his subsequent incarceration or the suppression. That's simply not so. If the police officers had been candid and forthcoming with the prosecutors or in the proceeding before Judge Duff, one of two things would have happened. As the Seventh Circuit found in the initial regarding the suppression hearing, all the evidence would have been thrown out and the case would have terminated at that time. Or alternatively, if the evidence had been somehow the suppression hearing could have continued at all, the evidence would have been presented before Judge Duff. He would have suppressed virtually the entirety of the case, and that would have been the end of the matter. Instead, there was a suppression hearing before Judge Duff. The falsities impropriety caused Judge Duff to reach the wrong conclusion. Mr. Ayanko had to go to trial. He lost. He had to appeal to this court once and get a new trial and a new suppression hearing. And then there was a subsequent second suppression hearing in which he prevailed. During that period of time, that's a period of 3 years, Mr. Ayanko, roughly 3 years in which Mr. Ayanko was incarcerated due to the failure to disclose evidence. The evidence being, among other things, the NCIC report.
Now, that report, because I understand your argument there, wasn't that information, that is, the false report, wasn't that available to Ayanko, or didn't it provide information that he could have investigated himself?
Mr. Ayanko's counsel...
In other words, it could be available to counsel via subpoena... or perhaps he could have testified about it at trial.
Ultimately he did find that report and locate it, but that's not the test. Your Honor's opinion, when you're sitting as a district court, Locke held that a defense counsel's responsibility did not have the responsibility to monitor other ongoing criminal proceedings and subpoena transcripts from those proceedings. And it's simply history tells the tale of what occurred here. Mr. Ayanko had experienced trial counsel at the time, And the report was unavailable. It was simply not located by anyone.
How did the information in the material relate to the issue at trial, or to any issue at trial?
Well, at trial, the suppression motion would have been renewed and would have prevailed if the NCIC report had been produced at that time. The NCIC report, history tells the importance of that and the significance of that report. Without it, Mr. Ianco lost the first suppression hearing, and a bevy of evidence came in because of that.
Did the police officers in any way stand in the way of presenting the NCIC report?
Yes, I believe they did.
I'm not talking about what they said at the suppression hearing. I'm talking about after that. Ianco all along knew, I assume he told his lawyers, that we presented the IDs right away. Right?
I would assume we were not. I was not involved, and I believe our.
Oh, I know. Yeah. I mean, but we have to assume that Ianco knew that, since that's what he said all along, right?
Well, the police officers didn't disclose what they were typing into the computer. All Mr. Ianco knew is that there was some typing going on in the front of a police squadron car when he was probably in a very scared state. To draw from that that Mr. Ianco should have known about a particular type of report and how to access that, I think it significantly inverts the burdens of proof.
Yeah, but isn't that what Gauger and Wiley and maybe others require, is that the police have to have a continuing impact? And I don't remember, what is it? One was a false confession, another was planted evidence, I believe, both of which they went on to prove it. In this case, the evidence that was found may have been in violation of the search, but it was criminal evidence and it was real.
The evidence of the ongoing improprieties here, I do not believe could be more real. There's a police report that's created shortly after the illegal search, which obfuscates the nature of what occurred significantly. That police report is then the basis for a stipulation at the first suppression hearing as to the city or the government's rendition of what occurred. One of the officers testifies at the first suppression hearing, and presumably he spoke to the prosecutor in advance of that hearing. There were also communications between the officers and the federal government around the time the warrants are being issued. So we've got conversations around the time the warrants are being issued. We've got the false police report. We've got conversations in advance of the first suppression hearing. Both of these officers also testified at the trial, as I recall, and offered the same improbable renditions of fact. They presumably were prepared by the AUSA in advance of that trial.
Now, wait a minute. Can you prove that?
Can I?
That they were prepared by the assistant U.S. attorney to lie?
Oh, not to lie. And
said they were prepared to give the false information.
I meant they were prepared in the way a witness is prepared by a lawyer as to what.
Then why did you say to give the false information?
If I said that, I stand corrected, and that's not what I meant to say.
All right.
There's.
I have a fundamental problem with your Fourth Amendment claim because, you know, it was raised in the original complaint. But that claim was abandoned before the district court. So don't you have a problem?
Didn't he explicitly withdraw it?
Those claims were abandoned.
I was talking before about the Fifth Amendment claim. As to the Fourth Amendment claim, I think the context of what occurred is important in which to judge the backdrop of the alleged waiver. The count was a two-count complaint. The first claim for relief under 42 U.S.C. 1983. At the time, that sort of civil rights malicious prosecution claim was a Fourth Amendment claim. The second count was a state law malicious prosecution count. In the body of the first count, various constitutional amendments were referenced. in response to a Rule 12b-6 motion by the city, not by the individual defendants, there's a statement in the response brief that says something to the effect of, we recognize that our malicious prosecution claim is grounded in the Fourth Amendment. That's what occurred, and that was the basis of the district court's initial finding of waiver. As to what occurred in the Court of Appeals the last time we were here, we didn't raise the statute of limitations in our opening brief. That came up in the response brief, where the government stated that to the extent you're using Fourth Amendment cases, they're time barred. We said this is a Newsom type claim at this juncture. That's not the background of a knowing, clear waiver, especially in light of a clear change in the law, which we're entitled to take advantage of procedurally.
Well, didn't the district court say in one of its rulings that certain claims were outside the scope of the malicious prosecution claim, and then there was no challenge to the district court's finding of abandonment and no development of a new theory of relief under the Fourth Amendment?
The failure of the development was due to the fact that at that time the law was very, very clear in this circuit that a Fourth Amendment claim was time-barred. It arose at the time of the arrest. Gauger made clear that that's no longer the law, and the Wiley case recognized that the previous decisions had been straightforward, had proposed an inflexible rule.
But in both of those cases, you had manufactured evidence. One was a false confession, coerced, or whatever they want to say. The other was manufactured. Yeah. It wasn't the real evidence. And the police went on and basically testified to that and carried it through the trial. That's the difference what we have here. This was real evidence. The problem was, I think, the initial stop, right? Isn't that where this all started, when they went and stopped them without going in and talking to the person who was being extorted or whatever?
I think the fundamental problem here is not the initial stop. It's that Mr. Ionko, at his Fourth Amendment suppression hearing, did not get the due process to which he is entitled. He was entitled to garner and develop the evidence which supported a suppression at that hearing.
It supported suppression because they didn't have a right to stop him in the first place, because they just asked for IDs, he gave them to them, and the police lied.
The police.
So it went on, because frankly, they didn't search the car until well after he was arrested, when they found the keys on the floor, right? And that's when all of the bad evidence came in. And after that, at that point, the person who was being extorted had already identified them. So whatever happened, it's that initial stop that seems to create the Fourth Amendment problem, when why it would have been suppressed, at least the way I understand it.
It should have been suppressed, all of it initially. Instead of that, Mr. Ionko spent a substantial amount of additional time in jail because of the lies, the false police reports, the failure to disseminate the NCI support. I see my light is going off. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Sure.
Thank you.
Ms. Notes?
May it please the court. Following this court's remand, Mr. Ionko amended his complaint to assert a fair trial claim of the type recognized in Newsom. This claim required Mr. Ionko to show that the defendant police officers had deliberately concealed exculpatory information, thereby preventing the prosecutors from discharging their Brady duties. Mr. Ionko also sought to resurrect a Fourth Amendment claim that had been dismissed before his first appeal and that was not argued in that appeal. This morning, I will explain that Mr. Ionko's Fourth Amendment claim is time barred, and that the police did not deprive Mr. Ionko of his right to a fair trial because they did nothing to prevent either the prosecutors or defense counsel from obtaining the information that ultimately supported Mr. Ionko's defense. On the sanctions issue, I will rest on our brief as well as on our motion to strike, which this court has taken with the case. With respect to Mr. Iancos' Fourth Amendment claim, as the panel has recognized, there are waiver issues, and I'm going to rest on our brief on all questions of waiver. On the statute of limitations issue, this case is indistinguishable from at least two prior decisions of this court, Booker versus Ward and Washington versus Somerville. In Booker and Washington, the defendant was arrested without probable cause. A motion to suppress the fruits of the unlawful arrest was granted much later, and the prosecution was ultimately abandoned. And in both cases, this court held that the Fourth Amendment claim accrued at the time of arrest, not when the criminal case ended. This case is no different, and as a result, Mr. Iancos' Fourth Amendment claim, brought more than 2 years after his arrest, is time barred. To be sure.
When should he have filed it then?
When should he have filed his claim?
Mm-hmm.
Within 2 years of his arrest.
I know, but what? At what point should he have known that he had the Fourth Amendment claim?
Mr. Ionko, it's quite clear from the testimony he gave throughout the criminal proceedings, recognized from the very start that he believed he had been arrested without probable cause, that he had been detained, put in the police car when the officers had no reason to suspect he did anything wrong. He should have filed suit at that time or within 2 years of that time. That is the direct holding of Booker versus Ward and Washington versus Somerville.
Now, does that square all right with Wiley and Gauger?
Indeed it does, for the reasons Your Honor just articulated. In Gauger and Wiley, this court held that when a civil rights plaintiff claims that the police fabricated crucial evidence of guilt, that claim is necessarily inconsistent with any conviction, and accrual is delayed. But in this case, there was no evidence of such fabrication, and Gauger and Wiley are therefore inapplicable.
So it's your position that the right to sue or the statute doesn't begin to run until after the conviction is nullified. You're saying that that doesn't apply here.
Exactly, that does not apply in this case because there is no evidence that these police officers fabricated crucial evidence of guilt. So therefore, success on their false arrest claim would not be inconsistent with a valid conviction. That's how this court has construed Heck in cases like Booker, Washington, Gauger, and Wiley. This case is akin to Booker and Washington. It's exactly the same. It's different from Gauger and Wiley. On the due process claim, first of all, I acknowledge that taking the evidence in the light most favorable to Mr. Iancos, there is no question that the police lied at the suppression hearing and at trial. Nevertheless, as this court held in the prior appeal, the police have immunity for that testimony, and nothing else the police did violates the Constitution. Gauger holds that false reports and false statements to prosecutors do not violate due process where, as here, the civil rights plaintiff knows that those reports and statements are false. That is why Mr. Iancos relies solely on the NCIC Leeds report. But the police never suppressed that report. That report was always available to prosecutors and defense counsel, and therefore it was not concealed. If the court has no further questions, we respectfully request that the judgment of the district court be affirmed.
Okay, I guess not. Mr. Callum?
Thank you. Briefly, as to the claim that the Fourth Amendment claim accrued at the time of the arrest, that would fly in the face of Judge Duff's suppression order, which said there was not a problem. You can't have a suppression order saying the search is legitimate and a claimant bringing a claim saying, no, it's not civilly.
Even when Mr. Iancos knows that the police lied at the suppression hearing.
That's correct. There's an inherent tension between Judge Duff's order and bringing a claim saying basically that a civil rights claim, basically that's wrong. And that's the type of tension that Heck recognized and that Gauger and the recent Wiley decision reprise. As to the claim that there's some type of absolute immunity here based on Gauger, the Gauger decision was real quick to point out that no exceptions to the absolute immunity claim had been advanced. There was no complaining witness exception advanced. There was no claim of the nature brought in the Mannion case or Manning case in this case. And that is dispositive. We are arguing those types of exceptions, which continue to exist. All Gauger had argued was that the – I'm sorry, I'm out of time. May I finish my thought?
You've got another minute, but finish up.
All Gauger had recognized was that you can't say that the witness had an absolute duty to tell the truth. He lied. He didn't do that. That was the sum and substance of the argument the plaintiff and Gauger advanced, and the court said no. But there's several paragraphs in that opinion that make clear that the complaining witness exception and Manning-type exceptions continue to exist. If they didn't, Newsom would have been wrongly decided, Jones would have been wrongly decided, and this court's opinion the first time the case was up, Ienko would have been wrongly decided. So what you have to look at what was done to induce the case to continue. In this case, we have ample evidence of that. We have the NCIC report, which I discussed before. We have the false police reports. We have the testimony, which can't suffice in and of itself, but coupled with the rest of these components is an ample exception to the absolute immunity rule. And for that reason, we would request that both the Fifth Amendment and the Fourth Amendment claims be reinstated. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much. Thanks to both counsel. This case we take.